You're listening to episode 189 of Women Worldwide. You may be storytelling about your brand, but are you a courageous marketer? Do you have what it takes to cut through the clutter? And do you know how to stay ahead? Stay tuned to learn more. Hi, I'm Deirdre Breckenridge. I've spent an entire career helping women to share stories, nurture relationships, grow their brands, but most of all, to find their voices so they can make a difference. Do you feel stuck? Do you want to power up your own voice? Women Worldwide features the stories of passionate women who have navigated big career challenges and some of the toughest changes. These professionals offer deep insights and advice to inspire you and to help you uncover what's holding you back. Let Women Worldwide ignite your passion so you can excel in life. Welcome to another episode of Women Worldwide. Let's talk about what it takes to be a courageous marketer. That word courage. Now, even before we get to the professional courage as a marketer, just courage in general, personally, professionally, sometimes it's digging so deep within yourself when it doesn't look like there's a path, drawing out that strength and being able to move forward. And that's something that we need to embrace today, and especially when you're a marketer. And if you think about it, the brand's life and activities is in your hands. What you're doing, the way that you're reaching people, getting them excited or having them rally around what you do or purchase your products, that's a big responsibility. You know, how do you stand out? And how do you possibly get recognized? CMOs today, they have to have courage and they need to cut through the clutter. That is a given. They have to have both sides of their brains working. It's not just the artful side, but it's the scientific side as well. And that's where my special guest comes in today. And I am so happy that we have Drew Neisser joining us on the show because he understands the role of the CEO and what it takes to break through. Let me tell you a little bit about Drew. He is the founder and CEO of Renegade, a company that helps courageous CMOs to cut through so they can stay ahead. Drew has many different ways that he is helping CMOs. He's a CMO advisor, an author, a keynote speaker, a podcaster. He is an Ad Age columnist. I would consider him a dogged student. And he's helped dozens of CMOs create marketing programs that are worth writing about. And he's told the story of over 250 CMOs via his CMO Spotlight column for Ad Age. And he also has a podcast series called Renegade Thinkers Unite. And his first book, The CMO's Periodic Table, A Renegade's Guide to Marketing, which we're going to talk about. So enough of everything that I'm saying about Drew, because he is here to share his story with you. Drew, it's great to have you on my show. Welcome.
Oh my God, it's great to be on your show. I want to hire you as my press agent with that introduction.
Thank you. I cannot believe everything that you're doing. And I think for the audience, so that they kind of get to know you a little bit more too, maybe you could just share how you got started in marketing and working with CMOs. Tell us a little bit of your backstory.
Well, my marketing story goes actually all the way back to when I was a student at Duke University. And I had the opportunity to run these film series. And in order to get folks to these movies, and I'm a big fan of 30s and 40s American films, I really wanted to get a big crowd there. So I created flyers and I went around and I posted them. I created ads for the student newspaper. And it was like, it really worked. I got people to the theater. And while they were there, I shared my enthusiasm, some insights about the movies. And I saw that it worked. It was amazing. People came back and they actually enjoyed some of the things I was sharing as much as they did the movie. And so anyway, I thought, well, I seem to be good at it. It seems to be working. Maybe that's a good career for me.
That's awesome. I mean, starting with ads and seeing it working, you know, and today, if you think about it, that's a part of what we do, a part of that CMO role and all the things that CMOs have to think about. So did you, I've looked at your background, you were always agency, correct?
Yeah. And it's funny, I started my career in the traffic department of Wells Rich Greene. They had an office in California. That's an agency that's defunct, but some folks will remember the famous Mary Wells Lawrence, who was known as the Scheherazade of advertising. But in truth, I learned everything you weren't supposed to do in marketing. So I was lucky enough to get a job in New York at JWT in their training program and essentially started my career again, worked on things like Listerine and Lubriderm, and really got a great foundation for marketing. And from there, went to Chiat/Day, where sort of account planning was a huge part of it. So learned a lot about strategy and also how to lose clients, because Chiat/Day was unbelievably good at that. So anyway, and then had an opportunity when I went to work for the Japanese at Dentsu, just because I've always been looking for something different. The traditional agency, both the model and the services that they provided, always felt too limiting to me. So when I got the opportunity with Dentsu to start a group, that which became Renegade, I took advantage of that. And 10 years after that, I bought Dentsu out, and now I'm the sole proprietor of Renegade.
That's an amazing journey. You know, I can relate to all the things you learn not to do. I mean, I know I hear people talk about, oh, I got such a rich insights into the traffic or the project management or what it means to run a campaign or to be a CMO. But I do think that learning what not to do is what propels us forward so much of the time.
Yeah, it's true. You learn more from your mistakes. I just wish I made fewer of them.
Yeah, I think sometimes we all, in hindsight, we can say, oh, goodness, yeah. I was a part of that.
Yes, indeed. But it's funny, you asked about, you know, always being on the agency side. And I think for me, one of the things that I learned is that I need different types of challenges in my life. And that agency side always presented that more so than the client side for me.
Definitely. And, you know, I mentioned courage in the beginning. Were you seeing, as you progressed through your career on agency side, this courage developing in the folks that were around you and also within yourself?
Well, it's funny. I think when you start an agency that is called Renegade, you sort of set the bar pretty high for yourself and for your clients. And so it's always been baked in as a promise to our clients that we would be courageous and present ideas and programs that they weren't necessarily expecting or sometimes even comfortable with, but they knew that's what they came to us for. So I think I was lucky in that our promise has always been about, well, we have to cut through and same is lame, so let's do something extraordinary. And for that to happen, the clients definitely needed the courage to say yes.
Oh, I like that, the courage to say yes. That's right, because so much of the time, we guide, we advise, we share what we believe the market wants and needs, but you can only take that so far. It's the client at the end of the day who has to have the courage too. That's an excellent point.
Right. Part of that is picking the right clients, and that's a process too. So I can't say we've always done that, but certainly when we do, where we're so as selective as our clients are, the match is much better. And then there's just all sorts of expectation management on both sides. And I think that's one of those things that CMOs really get very good at in their careers as well, as expectation management, because they are doing anything that we sell to them, they have to sell internally. And so it's, again, we live up to our promise. They have to buy into that.
Yes, definitely. Both sides have to meet and understand those expectations. Okay, so Drew, let's pivot over to your book, because I'm so curious. So you wrote the CMO's Periodic Table, A Renegade's Guide to Marketing. And I'm just wondering, What was the inspiration behind this? And when did you make the decision that you were going to write the book? Or did this kind of come together as you were working with different CMOs?
It was really sort of a bizarre, serendipitous moment. I was having lunch with an acquaintance through the Duke Alumni Network, and he mentioned he was working on a book. And I said, well, I've done these, you know, I've done 100 interviews in CMOs. And he goes, looks at me sort of, goes, well, dude, there's got to be a book in there. And I said, well, yeah, I wanted to write a book. And so sure enough, it took me about 3 weeks after that to sort of come up with the structural idea for the book. And the periodic table was just sort of perfect because it allowed me to sort of orchestrate and organize all of these elements that CMOs need to sort of take into account in order to do their job. They don't use all 64 elements all the time, and the great CMOs really are the masters of picking the right elements at the right time in their situation. So anyway, I wanted to write a book. When I did the periodic table and sort of organized that, I found that I had about 75% of the interviews I needed. So then I went and got the other 25, and I went back to the original folks that I had interviewed and got some more content, and voila, a book.
Wow.
Took about 9 months.
That's unbelievable. And I've written books, so I know the love and the labor. So as you were interviewing these CMOs, you saw consistency in 64 different elements? Is that kind of how you pulled it together?
No, it was actually the opposite. Is sort of the CMO role is the most bespoke in the C-suite. I mean, if you go to a CFO and you look at their job in comparison at any company, they do the same things. Their responsibilities are pretty much the same. The CMO is so different. Sometimes, for example, they could be in charge of marketing and customer service, marketing and sales, marketing and new product development, and even in some cases, HR. So they have this very broad spectrum. And also, they tend to speak a different language than the CEO. They're sort of thinking about both brand and demand gen, and the CEO is thinking about top line revenue and profit and all of those things. And so what I realized after the 100 or so interviews is how different this job was. And so what a great CMO could do is sort of pick the things they need in that moment, in that very specific moment, and apply them with some general principles in mind. So no CMO can be a master of all 64 of these elements, but the great ones know which ones to tap into when.
Yeah, that's fascinating. Can you just give us I'm sure there's so many big takeaways from your book, but maybe you could just give us a few of them and share what stood out the most to you.
So it's funny, after I wrote the book, a lot of people asked this question. So what are the big takeaways? And I started to think about it as I was giving keynote addresses and so forth. And I addressed these elements to lesser and greater extent in the book, but it's certainly a through line in successful CMOs. The first is courage, which you mentioned at the top of the show. And this is the courage to be unique and make sure that the brand is unique in the way not only it presents itself, but even in defining the problem that they solve. So many brands simply say, hey, we're better than our competition because of that. That's not unique. That's just comparison. The brands that can find a unique way of positioning themselves to solve a problem that the customer may not even realize they had, those are the truly amazing CMOs who find this way. And I tell the story that under the chapter of courage, there was the CMO at the time of a grocery store chain who bet the ranch, literally 25% of profits. He knew that if this was unsuccessful, he would lose his job. But instead, it ended up being incredibly successful. And what was interesting about part of the interview was he said most of his career, he had his eye on the competition. It was when he took his eye off the competition and simply put it back on the consumer that his career started to take off. And I thought that was fascinating. It was a great insight, but it was also a demonstration of courage. When you're betting the ranch, you're really there. So that was number one. There are three others I can cover.
Yeah, if you would, that would be great.
So, and I made it really simple. There's an acronym CATS, C-A-T-S, and the other three are artful, thoughtful, and scientific. So when you bring those together, you have courage, artful, thoughtful, and scientific. So the artful part is a very nuanced notion. And one is no CMO can do it on their own. So they artfully have to build a team and artfully present their work to the organization. They also tend to be better storytellers. The great ones tend to be better storytellers than the ones that aren't. And, you know, storytelling is a sort of an overused term, but it truly is an expression of artfulness, because the great sort of folks realize that they're not the hero of their own story, whether they're the CMO and they're talking to me, or they're always giving credit to other people, or when they're talking about their brand, you know, the customer is the hero. So that artfulness and that thinking about artfulness is a profound level of sort of like it pushes them up, as opposed to, say, the bully approach. Hey, do it this way. Here's how we're going to go. You know, that works once.
Right. Command and control.
Command and control. Marketers generally can't do that. They're always begging for resources. So the next one is thoughtful. And again, this is a nuanced notion, but this relates a lot to where marketing is headed, which is thinking about how marketing can be a service to your prospects and customers is a profound way of differentiating your brand. And so thoughtful means doing stuff, not saying stuff, whether it's creating a tool that makes it easier for your customer to sort of buy your product, or creating content that helps them be smarter. It's a thoughtfulness as opposed to, again, that sort of in your face, buy my product, because it's here's some information that you can use that will really benefit your life or your job. And in that process, you become, you endear yourself to your customer. And then the last one is kind of obvious, but you'd be surprised. There are some CMOs that don't have as much science as they need to do the job successfully. So the science is always, you know, if we look at basic scientific theory, it's you're always creating hypothesis and testing, right? That's a fundamental part of science. So that's one, they're always testing. Two, they have some basic measures in place. And then the third part of this, today with all the marketing technology, it's easier than ever to be a marketing scientist.
Yeah. And so I think what you're saying is you really have to be more hands-on with the data and being able to analyze the findings, maybe even statistical forecasting. Is that a part of the scientific?
Yeah. I mean, I think that, again, the great CMO, like any great leader, sets the vision, builds the team, and allocates the resources, right? So if you're building the team, you better have a data person on your team who's really ahead of the game when it comes in that area. The CMO doesn't have to do it themselves unless it's a small company.
Okay.
They just need to know what questions to ask and how, you know, and this is where, you know, if I had, we had some marketing professors on the line, they might say there aren't enough people who actually understand marketing to know what you need to measure. But a great CMO knows what they need to measure. They have a brand tracking study. They know that there are these intangible measures that you need to understand for brand health that really do matter, because there are other marketplace forces that could drive sales down that could be beyond your control. And so you need brand health indications. And so that's just part of the science. And the great CMOs know what to measure.
Absolutely. And if, like you said, if they're not doing it themselves, it's to put the team in place. Although that always gets challenging with resources, because you did mention smaller companies where you might have to step in. And or just in your understanding, do you see, did you meet any CMOs, or did you talk to CMOs who go back and get some kind of continuing education to, I don't know, have a better understanding of the scientific part, or have their teams do that?
Well, it's funny. More and more of the CMOs that I've been talking to recently, because I've been focused on MarTech a lot. And so, for example, I just talked to a woman who is the CMO of MongoDB, and she has an engineering background, and she in their platform, and she mentions this on the show, she has 28 different marketing technology pieces of software that she is managing and orchestrating. Now, she has a data scientist who is leading that charge, but she totally understands that world. You have others that are sort of newer to that world who are better on the brand side. But to really answer your question, which I now have completely forgotten. But I know I have a great answer to it.
It's if they're going back for continuing education.
Oh, yes. Thank you. Yes. The answer is yes, they do. And they do it in a number of ways. They network. One of the organizations I've been involved with for years, which is how I've gotten so many of these interviews, is the CMO Club. They get together, they talk, they share their issues. And that's really, really critical. I mean, anyone that thinks they understand this game, given how fast it's changing, is mistaken.
Right. Because you don't know what you don't know.
Exactly right.
So, Drew, I'm just going to ask you to hold all of your thoughts just for a moment. We're going to go to a super quick break, give some love to our sponsors, Pure Performance and PrepDish. And Drew, have you ever heard of PrepDish?
I haven't.
Okay, well, for on-the-go CMOs and for any executives or owners of companies, this is a meal planning service that can really help.
I love it.
This episode of Women Worldwide is brought to you by PrepDish. Let me ask you something. Do you struggle with prepping your meals in advance? And are you tired of asking yourself over and over again, what should I eat today? And better yet, are you sick of your family asking you, what's for dinner? And then hearing, oh no, not that again. Well, you don't have to worry about that anymore. That's where PrepDish comes in. A subscription-based meal planning service, PrepDish is going to save you time and helps to make your dinners much more appealing and really tasty too. It's so simple. Here's how PrepDish works. Every week, you receive a weekly meal plan with a grocery list. You know upfront all of the ingredients that you need to have to prep for the entire week. You do your shopping. You set aside 2 or 3 hours to prepare everything in advance. So for example, prepping on a Sunday sets you up for the entire week of meals. And if you think about it, your meals just became easy. You're saving time, you're more efficient in the kitchen, but best of all, you and your family are eating meals that are different, nutritious, and delicious too. I love the sweet potato frittata and the superfood salad, so you might want to check those out. So that's why with my crazy schedule, I let PrepDish do the planning for me. And now you can too. PrepDish has a fantastic offer for you, the Women Worldwide listener. You can go to PrepDish.com/worldwide and get 2 weeks of PrepDish free. Try it. You'll love it. PrepDish.com/worldwide.
Creating brand loyalty requires a unique blend of strategic communications and innovative technology. Yesterday's techniques won't work. Today, you have an opportunity to expand your communications approach with fresh, creative, and effective ways to power up your brand voice through new channels and to interact with more value and meaning. Pure Performance Communications will work with you to move audiences from awareness to action and impact. You'll foster greater engagement and forge stronger relationships along the way. Let us help you uncover what's holding you back and help you to carve out a marketing and PR roadmap to success. Visit us at pureperformancecom.com. That's pureperformancecom with 2 M's.com. Now back to Women Worldwide with Deirdre Breckenridge.
Hi, I'm Deirdre Breckenridge. Welcome back to the show. Drew Neisser and I were just chatting about his book, The CMO's Periodic Table, A Renegade's Guide to Marketing. Drew, you were enlightening us on CATS, your acronym, and we were just ended on the scientific part. I would love to hear your thoughts because you have interviewed so many CMOs. Is there a difference between responses that you saw from male CMOs versus female CMOs in the spirit of Women Worldwide?
Yeah, you know, I'm so glad you asked that question because first, I have to tell you that I have a harder time getting women CMOs on the show. And I didn't notice that until about episode 80 when one of my listeners said, when I asked, hey, what else can I cover? She said, well, get more women on the show. And I went back and counted and it was about 60, 40 or 65, 35. And it wasn't by design. I think some of the CMOs, women CMOs that I've reached out are reluctant to put the spotlight on themselves. So I thought that was interesting. So I've worked hard to fix that in the sense that I keep, you know, I reach out to more women than men. And when I do get them on the show, I feel like we have more honest conversations.
Fantastic.
They seem to be a bit more self-aware and able to translate their experiences into lessons that others can learn. There's sort of just a general nurturing nature. And so we talk a lot more about building and nurturing teams on those shows than we might say execution. And I think this also goes back to the reluctance to talk about themselves. They're very quick to say, it was all about my team. I mean, and Alan Hart, who has a podcast called Marketing Today, and I have talked about that and how, and he always interviews folks who've won awards. And he say, well, what do you credit winning the award for? And every woman that he has ever asked, he said, well, always goes back to the team. And I think it's true, it does, but they are just quick to give others more credit. And so that's, you know, again, I think goes back to the reluctance to put themselves on the spotlight. But what we haven't talked about on the show yet and on my show is the challenge that women face in male-dominated C-suite and boards. I know this is a fundamental issue. I've talked to a number of CMOs who want to be on boards. And you know the numbers are really poor because there's a very small percentage of marketers at all on boards. And even a smaller percentage of women. And so I'm going to actually do an episode with three CMOs at a time, all of whom have managed to get on boards and just talk about the hurdles that they've had to overcome.
That's fantastic because the numbers are so low. Like you said, just in marketing alone, and then that slice of women. So I know that there have been women on this show who have said that we need more women on boards. We've actually had some women who themselves are coaching to help other women to get on board. So I do think that having those role models and women who have done it to help others is so important, as well as men, because men are just as much a part of this climb, so to speak. So I hope in the future to see that. And I think that would make an excellent, excellent show for you.
Yeah, I agree. And I think it's really interesting because I think what they will discover is a couple of things they need to do. One, they probably need to get some operational experience because marketing is considered a soft art in the boardroom as opposed to finance and legal and operations. So that's one route. And then the other thing that CMOs typically are sort of criticized when they go on a board of directors is that they think they're still the CMO and they don't quite understand what the role of the board is. And that, by the way, is true for male and female CMOs. But I think female CMOs really need to think about that and understand they're in an advisory role, not a line role. And so those two things, get some operational experience and B, understand what your role is on a board, it sets you up for success.
That's two really good points. And I'm sure very helpful to listeners who are at a point in their career that they know that they want to be on a board, but just to understand that you need that operational experience and also what you said about it's a different role, keeping that in mind as they're learning and discovering and making that leap and having the courage to do that as well. One thing I want to point out that you said about speaking with women, the honest conversations and how much credit that they give to their teams. I find that leaders who do that in general excel, male or female. That's what people look for in leaders, to know that, you know, if your team is doing well, if you give credit to the team, that it's a reflection of the leader himself or herself. But that's fascinating.
Yeah.
So let's talk a little bit. I'd actually like to pivot more personally, maybe to you, if you don't mind.
Okay.
So you're doing a lot. You own your company, Renegade. You're an author. You know, I mentioned speaking. You mentioned it as well. You have your column. Clearly, you're a podcaster, and I love talking to other podcasters. How are you managing all of this? You know, are you using resources? What's helping you during the day to get all of this done?
Well, in truth, as you know, as an entrepreneur, for the pleasure of working for myself, I get to work a few more hours every week. But that said, there are some principles that help this become a little more efficient. I mean, one, and somebody gave this advice to me a long time ago, as the CEO, I try only to do the things that only I can do. I can't say that I do that perfectly, maybe 80% of the time, but everything else that I think someone else on the team can do, I try to delegate. And I have a great team here at Renegade who, you know, I don't edit this, my podcast, just like you don't edit podcasts. I don't do the show notes. I don't do the transcription. I have people that help me through that. That's sort of one is you obviously need a good team and you need to understand how to delegate. And then I think from a sort of managing all those extracurriculars, the thought leadership stuff that I create, it's very focused in this way. When I'm interviewing, the people that I try to interview are folks that I think are going to address a topic of interest to our clients, not prospects, of clients. So, for example, I did an interview with Brent Adamson, who ended up being two episodes, who is a author and Gartner consultant. And I did that because I knew one of our clients was particularly interested in the challenger customer. And so that piece of content, what happened is this particular CMO listened to it twice, then made our whole team listen to it, and we had a common language that we could sort of work out. So it was very focused in terms of what it is that I'm trying to do with the content. And then that way I know at least my primary audience really got tremendous value out of it. And the second thing, and I'm sure you do this too, which is each episode is a springboard for several other pieces of content. So every episode becomes an Ad Age, or just about every one becomes an Ad Age column. That's what the column is based on the interview for the podcast. It becomes a blog post on renegade.com. It sometimes gets featured in our newsletter. And then the best ones end up in, we create these ebooks on occasion for renegade.com. And of course, there's a lot of fodder in these interviews for book number two.
Oh, yes. And is book number two coming soon? Or you can't answer that.
You know, it's so I know what it is. And the book number two is essentially around this notion of renegade thinking and what it means to be that. The one thing about business books that I can advise any of you that want to write a business books are about sort of delivering hope. And that there's a formula that they can follow that if they use that, they will be successful, right? And so at the risk of oversimplifying, business books that sort of give you a simple path are more successful than others. And I think if there was one critical error in Renegade in my first book, it was that I basically said, this is a really hard job and you're going to have to figure it out on your own. And so the next book is really going to be far more prescriptive, get into the, so if we're talking about courage, what does that really mean? How do we become courageous? How do we know when to do that? If we're talking about artfulness, what does that really mean? So it's about creating a sort of mental mindset. And I also actually know what my third book will be too. But
oh my goodness, you're amazing. But you're right about a formula. Right? It's so important. And then people can walk away with something very concrete that they can try to apply. I can't wait to see your second book. And now you're talking about your third too.
Yeah. Well, the third book is the book that I really want to write, which is hilarious.
Tell me more about your idea. We're all curious.
So one of my heroes is Benjamin Franklin. And he's a hero of mine because I consider him America's first chief marketing officer. He sold a revolution to a king, to the French king. If you think about a sales job, a marketing job, what could be more difficult? Sell a revolution from one king to another king. And yet he did it. And the funding that we got and the soldiers and the weaponry and everything really basically allowed us to win the Revolutionary War. We don't do it without France and without Franklin. And so part of me wants to sort of write about Franklin as America's first chief marketing officer. I have a more clever way of getting at it. But the other thing that Franklin said, which was really a lightning bolt for me, was well done is better than well said. And that has been a mantra for me in our organization and for our clients. It's like, don't focus so much about what you're saying because that's messaging. Focus on what you're doing because that's value.
That's thoughtful too. That's a part of CATS.
Exactly. It's all about, and he, when I give my keynote on a get to the section of thoughtful, Franklin's picture is right there.
that's awesome. I do hope you write that book.
Oh, me too.
Yeah. So you have quite a road ahead.
Yes, I
a
do.
A lot of writing and thought leadership. Now, you mentioned before that CMOs and technology, and this begs the question about you and social media. So personally, how do you feel about social media? Love it? Could do without it? What are your thoughts?
Well, first of all, I personally love it, but I also have to say in 2008, when the market crashed and all of our guerrilla marketing business just sort of died instantly, we pivoted to social media and it saved the company. So I am grateful for this thing that came along. So I was an early adopter of Twitter and Instagram and LinkedIn and Facebook. But I have to say, Instagram is my breath of fresh air. I follow incredible photographers. So personally, it transports me. I'm on LinkedIn every day as a cheerleader for my CMO network and, of course, to push out my own content. I have a love-hate thing with Twitter. I mean, the feed is ridiculous, but I do get into some funny, interesting back-and-forth group conversations. And I think sort of last on my list is just I give less time to Facebook, but I do love the fact that it keeps me close to my friends.
That's good. Yeah, I mean, Facebook is really interesting because I do find that ever since Facebook Live, you've had this resurgence of people being on, whether it's personally doing something live or professionals doing something live. So that kind of interest, I was always love-hate with Facebook as well, but Facebook Live I do like and I appreciate. And I'm right there with you. Although I do love Twitter, well, I'm not going to lie. I know it's really, really noisy. So what I try to do is be very organized with my dashboard so that I'm only seeing what I need to see to help me, following the folks that feed me great information, or I'm watching my communities and my hashtags very closely. And that keeps away all of the noise and the nonsense. And Instagram, yeah, I don't have a big following and I can't say that there's a lot going on, but personally, I love it. I just love to post my pictures. And it is a blend, I guess, because, you know, you might do this too. You are who you are, whether it's you mentioned photography and how much you love that, but, you know, maybe there's professional things where you're at events and you're taking pictures and they're just as beautiful. So I use that as a blend. Well, I'm glad that you don't hate social media, and then it helped your company too.
Yeah, no, I couldn't. I need to stay active. And I think that's philosophically important for as marketers that we constantly, you have to use these tools to understand them. You can't just delegate it. And this is a conversation I have with a lot of CMOs as they're building their personal brands and thinking about it. You need to, you know, you don't have to be on all of them.
Right.
Pick the one that you really like and get into it to understand it. You just can't sort of sit in the office and have someone tell you what that means because you just won't get it. And as a result, you'll dismiss it unnecessarily or you'll overrate it. And so I think, you know, it's sort of back to Lincoln on leadership. Sometimes you just have to get out in the field and talk to the troops. Well, that's what you do with social media. You get out there and you listen and engage and you see what happens.
Absolutely. Sometimes you just have to roll up your sleeves and be present, because that's when you're present, that's where the best conversations and relationships can be built. So I agree with you there. Maybe you can just talk a little bit about what you've learned. What you've learned about yourself. I mean, if you were to look back at your early days at JWT or Shiat Day, maybe what have you learned?
Well, it's I hope I've learned a lot.
Such a big question, I know.
It is. There's a couple things that come to mind. One is that I've learned that I really am a marketing omnivore. One of the reasons that I keep interviewing CMOs is I just love learning, but also it's funny. I've come to the point where I realized that working on one business in one channel would just bore the heck out of me. And sort of, again, even at the bigger agencies, you'd just be working on Listerine, or I was just working on Sara Lee. And I found, well, no, I'd like to work on four. And so one of the great things about having an agency and having ADD is that I've set up a structure where I get to do a lot of different things. And the second thing that I think I realized, and this didn't happen until I was suddenly president of Renegade, was I need a lot of pressure to do my best. I need tight deadlines. I need crazy challenges. I need to multitask. And that brings out sort of the Renegade in me. If I'm just sort of working for someone with some specific tasks, I just don't challenge myself as much. It's weird.
Oh, wow. No, I mean, I hear a lot of people in agencies say how much they thrive on the pressure, the deadline, creative types, especially. When I owned my agency, I remember the designers and our creative director say how well they work under pressure and that deadline. So it's very fitting that you do that. And here I thought all these years that being an agency person myself, that always wearing different hats and loving to work on different things, maybe it was ADD.
Well, for me, I absolutely know it was. And I can trace it all the way, direct line, all the way to high school when I was trying to write a paper and I would write a sentence and I'd throw a dart for 10 minutes.
Yeah.
So I know that structurally, but the pressure, and what's funny, and some people are suited to this, and I think this is sort of, I'm a jock. I play a lot of sports, and I love that pressure. I love that moment of performance where you've got to either strike that golf ball or hit that tennis ball in the right place at the right time. And that pressure is something that I thrive on. And physically, I'm lucky in that it works for me. Right. I have a grandfather who was in the business, and his doctor told him to get out of the business in 1941. So it's funny. Constitutionally, I guess with low blood pressure and fast metabolism, I'm more suited to it than he was.
Boy, that works for you. All right, just to sort of round out the show, maybe you could give the listeners some advice on how they can be a better leader today.
So I think I've talked about this a little bit. One thing, it's funny, I would encourage you to read A Team of Rivals, which is Doris Kearns Goodwin's book on Lincoln and leadership. And it's an extraordinary story. But what it was is he took all his four basic people that ran against him, some of whom really disliked him and thought he was this rail splitter hick, brought them all onto his team. And ultimately, they all loved him and respected him. And he brought out the best in him. But they were all amazing individuals. So, you know, building the team of people who are a lot stronger than you. It's funny. So just one of my other heroes is my father, and episode 100 of Renegade Thinkers Unite is with my dad. Oh, and we talked, awesome. And it's just, we ended up talking about this, you know, it's a completely random show, by the way, but I did it because I could, and I love my dad, and it's just a wonderful thing.
Oh, I love that.
And he got a big kick out of it. He's 92 years old. Oh, we ended up talking about Lincoln. We just talked about what leadership is about. And so, you know, Lincoln had a vision, right? He set the vision. He saw a house divided, it will, you know, fall upon himself. So he set the vision. He built this team of extraordinary people. And then it was his job to allocate the resources. And he did. And, you know, what was particularly interesting is how many failures he had in his life. And even picking a general until he finally got to Grant, who was the one who could really execute his vision. And so it, you know, there's so many lessons there for all of us, which is you don't succeed every time, you've learned from those mistakes, but the principles of leadership, of setting the vision, building the team, and allocating the resources don't change. They're universal, whether you're a president or running your own company.
Excellent. Drew, where can people find out more about you and your work and your book?
It's all on renegade.com. We just sort of relaunched the website, and although we keep doing that, on it you'll find my bio, the podcast, Renegade Thinkers Unite, a link to the book, and you know how to book me for a speaker. So it's all there.
Terrific. Drew, thank you so much for coming on the show, sharing your journey, all of your advice. It was really interesting what you shared today, and just appreciate your time so much. So thank you.
Oh, thank you for having me. It was really fun talking to you.
Oh, anytime. And you have to keep us posted on those other books.
Yes, I will.
Absolutely. I hope everybody goes to your website and follows you. I also want to thank our sponsor, PrepDish, and Pure Performance for sponsoring this episode of Women Worldwide, and all of you listeners out there who continue to tune in. You're helping us to power up the voices and to create that energy that makes a difference to get to some impact. And also, if you have a moment, please tell us how you're feeling about the show. If you can, go to iTunes, rate us, give us a shout out on Twitter, because I'll be there, or Facebook. We always love to hear from you. Okay, WW friends, until our next episode, stay focused, energized, and feeling empowered. Thank you.